Well, let me say thank you very much for that very generous introduction. It's certainly not difficult to persuade me to pay a visit to Denmark and especially to Copenhagen. It's always a pleasure to be here. The only thing I would say with respect to the comments you made is that compared to the people I study, the wolf is a rather noble and dignified animal. It is true that I've spent a great deal of my career in academic life working on simply the study of measures of inequality and an effort to bring some coherence and intelligibility to what is a very complex, difficult, and messy topic. And I don't want to spend a lot of time here on the data, but it has been our major exercise to develop measures that are reasonably comparable across countries and reasonably effective as indications of the trends within countries. And we have recently conducted an exercise of comparing our estimates with the wider literature of measures and reported measures of inequality in quite a large number of countries around the world, and just picking one small and reasonably, allegedly well-organized and competently administered country to give you an example of what these data look like. I will just pull up this one. This is a country called Denmark. And these are measures of inequality going back to the 1960s, coming up to the last few years in Denmark. And what one of my students did was to go through the literature and to record the measures that had been reported in a variety of studies. And as you can see, I think I was justified in describing this as complex and extremely messy. There are three basic types of measures in the literature. The green, which are alleged to reflect the inequality of market incomes. The blue, which are a concept associated with gross incomes, that is to say, after accounting for non-market incomes, but before taking account of taxation, and the red, which is the disposable income or the actual inequality of purchasing power in the private sector after transfers and taxes are taken account of. And you can see that there's an extraordinary dispersion of those measures. That with respect to market inequality, even the small and relatively well-organized country shows a very high these are Gini coefficients, a very high measure of economic inequality, which is radically reduced by the mechanisms which both produce non-market incomes and mediate market incomes through taxation. And you get the low inequality measures that are known to characterize Denmark at the bottom of the table. Now, it should be obvious, though, that those market incomes are only as unequal as they are because of the welfare state. They're not something that could exist independently of the mechanisms of transfers and taxation that have been built up here and in other advanced countries over many years. That is to say, they reflect the fact that a great many households can exist without market incomes, which is only possible in a state which has very well-developed social structure. So it is, in fact, not bad news, but simply an artifact of the social structure. And the same is true for every other well-organized social democracy for which we have data. Here is Canada, Denmark again. There is Germany. Some of these measures are quite erratic. The black ones are our estimates, which tend to come in right in the middle, where they should, as estimates of gross income inequality. They're for a particular purpose of comparison. There's Japan, there's the Czech Republic, there's Russia, there's the United Kingdom. And you can see, as you, in the advanced and social democratic states, the disposable income measures are much lower than the market income measures. You can also see in this data, very clear sign that the income inequality measures have been going up in some respects, in most places, including in Denmark, although not by very much compared to other countries. Our approach, those measures marked in black on these charts, is based specifically on comparing structures of pay. That is to say, it is particularly useful for analysis of working conditions, of what is sometimes referred to, although I use the phrase with a good deal of hesitation, as the labor market. Our particular measures are focused on that. They tend to be particularly useful for that. They are not as good at estimating the effects of income inequality of changes in the valuation of financial capital and wealth, for which other data sources, including tax records, are more appropriate. But they are very good for coming to a general assessment of comparative social conditions and of comparative trends. What we find with respect to trends, and you can see this without, again, elaborating too much, here's the United States, for example, is that they are generally upward, particularly in the rather disastrous 20-year period that marked the neoliberal revolution, Reaganism, Thatcherism, and its offshoots around the world, beginning in 1980 and peaking around 2000. We find, in fact, that there is a global common pattern where inequality rises much more rapidly in countries which are vulnerable to severe financial crises, to the debt crises of the 1980s, to the collapse, of course, of the communist regimes in Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union, to the Asian crisis in the 1990s, and rises substantially less, although it does rise in most cases, in countries with strong social institutions and protections. That is obviously not a surprise. It's what you'd expect to find. And there's some reassurance in that the measures that we have developed reflect what an ordinary common sense would expect you to find. It is also pretty clear, especially when one takes into account the evidence from income measures, which are on this chart for the United States, particularly strongly reflected in the series, which is this one here, which has these very short peaks and valleys in the late 1990s and the mid-2000s, that income inequality measures are closely reflective of credit cycles and the run-up and then the consequences of financial crisis and crash. That is to say, rising income inequality in the United States and in much of the rest of the world, in fact, in just about every place that we have been able to examine data on this, has a very strong association with financial activity, with the extension of credit, information technology boom, and the real estate bubble in the United States in the mid-2000s, and has a tendency to recede in the aftermath of the crisis. That is, I have said, very similar to the effect of rising blood pressure in the human organism. It's a sign of trouble to come. When the crisis occurs, the symptom may recede, but damage has already been done. I think that's a useful way to think about how the inequality measures are connected to overall macroeconomic phenomena. The other aspect for which this data is useful has to do with analyzing the effect of levels of inequality across countries. And I will just make some very general assertions, which I believe to be valid. First of all, as a general rule, looking across the entire world, so far as we have measures which we believe to be reliable, richer countries are more equal than poorer countries. The essence of being a wealthy country is to have a lot of income concentrated in the middle of the distribution. The essence of being a poor country is to have a lot of income, a lot of people at the bottom of an income structure with very little income and a very small number at the top. But inequality and poverty are rather closely associated at the world scale. Secondly, Low inequality in structures of pay, which is what we measure directly, is closely associated with stronger social protections and the more effective provision of public goods and services, including education and healthcare. And there is no surprise as to why this should be the case. It is a historical fact that these things go together in the development of social democracy. Now, that is to say that when you have strong trade unions, they will do, on the one hand, achieve a certain compression of the pay structure, and on the other, they will be advocates, effective advocates, for the creation of effective pension systems, for national health insurance, and for effective public education, among many other things. So it's not surprising that low inequality is associated with strong social protections. These are not trade-offs, but complements. The third thing, which is a contribution of our research, is that low inequality in the pay structures of the countries that we observe tends to be associated with lower rates of unemployment on the whole. Lower rates of unemployment. And I want to just dwell on that momentarily, because it is a fact that is broadly in evidence, particularly when one examines the data for the European countries, and because it runs flatly against the ideological and theoretical line of the mainstream economic model, which has been saying to Europeans for many decades that the problem of eurosclerosis, phrase often heard before the crisis and somewhat less so since, it was a problem of excessively rigid labor markets to be dealt with by flexibilization. Highly loaded terms, which suggested that the problem of European unemployment was a failure to allow the price of labor, that is to say the wage, to find its market level, to adjust to its appropriate equilibrium value, particularly in the face of technological changes that were devaluing certain kinds of labor while upvaluing other kinds. That's a story with a lot of, let's say, pedagogical force, a lot of political force. And it's a story which has persisted even following the financial crisis. The only difficulty with the story is that there is, so far as we have been able to find, not a single shred of evidence that supports it. There is a problem in economics that when you say the theory contradicts the facts, it's so much the worse for the facts. But here is a case where I suggest that the facts really should be taken into account. There is a systematic relationship that does exist, and it runs in the other direction. As a general rule, over the post-war period, countries with less inequality of pay experienced less, not more, unemployment. Countries with what one might call more rigid labor markets have experienced less unemployment than those with very high degrees of inequality and apparent flexibility in their wage structures. Now, why would that be so? The answer is you can, in fact, find good reasons, even in economic theory, even in the published literature of mainstream economics, for this to be so. And I'll give two examples very quickly. One is a model from the early 1970s that has its origin in the study of economic development, Harris and Todaro, which made the point that when you have an unequal structure, they were looking at East Africa where there were urban wages much higher than the countryside, people migrate from one place to another. Because in order to get a chance at one of a small number of high-paid jobs, you have to take a risk of going and looking for it. And a lot more people will do that than are available, than are going to find the jobs, and the people who don't will be unemployed. And you can see this after Franco disappears from Spain. The countryside goes to the cities looking for industrial jobs. You have a large increase in unemployment in the Spanish context. It's not it's a phenomenon which is very common. You can see it all across the People's Republic of China as people come from the villages to the cities looking for much higher paid jobs than are available at home. Very simple, straightforward mechanism, which says the more inequality you have, the more unemployment you're going to have. What you do expect from that is what you find. And the second general model on this matter has its origins here in Scandinavia. It is the Swedish trade union model, the LO model, the model associated with Wren and Meidner, which held, beginning in the 1950s, I believe, and the text is from 1951, that if you had a compressed structure of wages, which is to say egalitarian pay structure, not a low pay structure, but an egalitarian one, that the effect of this would be on the composition of industry in your country, and that what would happen is that you would make life more difficult for low productivity firms, easier for highly competitive, high productivity firms, and you would migrate toward a higher productivity industrial structure and a higher living standard. And over time, I would argue over 50 years, this is the principal reason why Scandinavia got rich. Moving from half of the standard of the European median, roughly, to the top of the world's income structure, and why the extraordinarily advanced forms of manufacturing and also agriculture that one finds here were able to prosper. Because they, in fact, became essentially symbiotic with a high and egalitarian wage structure. Are there any apparent exceptions to this rule? Well, if you'll reflect on it, I think you'll find at least a few on which questions could be raised, including one very big one. Two small ones, however, first. We noticed that both Austria and Ireland tend to have industrial wage structures, which historically have maintained a discount with respect to their very large neighbors. Austria with respect to Germany, Ireland with respect to the UK. And this has helped those countries maintain high levels of manufacturing employment and high wages in every other sector. It's a very interesting phenomenon. Was this, however, the consequence of labor markets and wage flexibility? On the contrary. These are the two countries in Europe with the most centralized labor mechanisms that we could find. Austria, the wages were set at the central level. And this strategy, which was to attract industrial investment from the very large neighbor, was deliberate and effective. It's, however, a particular set of cases for small countries that are able to piggyback on much larger markets and much larger manufacturing systems. The other substantial exception is the comparison, the exception that was always made, always pointed to, in apparent support of the idea that more flexible labor markets will generate lower unemployment, is the comparison between the United States and Europe, where my country is said to be the country of highly flexible labor markets and low unemployment. And the European countries said to be the countries of highly rigid labor markets and high unemployment. The difficulty with that argument is that it is based on a series of comparisons that are paralyzing, country by country by country. A comparison, for example, of the United States with Denmark. We are a country of 320 million people, you're a country of 5.9 million people. And I assure you, if you want to find 5.9 million people in the United States who have a social democratic orientation and live in a cold northern climate surrounded by a rather unpleasant body of water, we got that in the United States. It's called Wisconsin. And Wisconsin is more egalitarian than the United States, just as Denmark is more egalitarian than the United States. So one has to ask, what is the proper framing of comparison? And if you compare the United States to Europe, particularly with respect to structures of pay, factoring in the vast inequalities across the European countries, from here to Romania, from Finland to Portugal, then the proposition that the United States is less equal, more unequal than Europe in pay structures actually goes away. Because we have had, since the New Deal, a structure in the United States which, while not as effective as the structures here in Denmark, nevertheless provides this for a minimum wage at the continental scale, for a social security system at the continental scale, for health insurance for the elderly and for the poor at the continental scale, Those report a vast array of other things, including unemployment insurance, one could go on, as well as common federal spending on such matters as defense, which balance out across the regions. So we've experienced actually a lot of regional convergence in the United States, and I would argue that we are therefore not a clear-cut exception to the general proposition that labor markets, if you want to use that term, tend to function better in more egalitarian societies. And if you wish to maintain a good functioning of a society, maintaining the basic accomplishments of the 20th century, the accomplishments of social democracy, which are many different steps and components, have many different steps and components, and that broadly provide a common foundation for economic security, for personal risk taking, for the movement to in and out of employment, then defending those institutions and protecting them and even expanding them and making them work at the broader continental level of which you are a part is the important task, and that the doctrine to which we have been subjected for so many decades, that we should be dismantling all of the social accomplishments of the past century and returning to the 19th, is just so much nonsense. Something, as John Maynard Keynes said, no one could believe who had not had their head fuddled with nonsense for years and years. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much for that great presentation. You covered quite a lot of subjects already. And